I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to The Connection. Our guest, psychiatrist Frank Anderson, knows trauma. As a clinician working with patients who are dealing with overwhelming life events, and as a much-in-demand public speaker on PTSD. He's also an expert on a more personal level, growing up in an abusive household at the mercy of his violent, rageful father. His parents sent him for 6 years of conversion therapy when he was a little boy. Afterward, Anderson determined to be, quote, normal, bearing his memories, feelings, his true self. Frank Anderson has written a memoir, To Be Loved, A Story of Truth, Trauma, and Transformation. It's a brutally honest account of how trauma can break a person apart and how therapy, in this case internal family systems, helped him reclaim and rebuild his identity. In the process, he came out as gay at the age of 32, got married, and became the father of two boys. In fact, it was being a parent that revealed Anderson's unaddressed trauma as he saw himself reacting like his father, angry and controlling. We asked Frank Anderson to join us today to talk about healing from trauma, about forgiveness, and the power of connection. And Frank Anderson, nice to have you with us on The Connection.
Well, thank you so much, Marty, for having me. It's really lovely to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. And I want to just read the very first sentence from the first page of your book. And you write, I was just 6 years old when I learned there was something seriously wrong with me. And you describe in pretty vivid detail being a six-year-old and going to your parents' bedroom. What happened?
Went to my parents' bedroom like we normally did. I have one brother and two younger sisters. And so it was a common occurrence for us to kind of wake up in the morning and, you know, plop into my parents' bedroom and, you know, just talk and things like this. But on this particular morning, which was really a change in my life trajectory, which is why it sticks out so profoundly for me, you know, on this particular morning, I went into the bedroom and, you know, clear as day, my dad said, you know, Frankie, you're not going to school today, which I didn't understand. I was confused by it. It didn't make sense. It wasn't summer vacation. Like, I wasn't sick. I wasn't aware of anything that was wrong. So it was kind of confusing. And to keep the ball rolling around the questions that I had, nobody really said why, yeah. Right? There was nothing that was like, there was no explanation as to what was going on, but we proceeded to get into the car. They drove me downtown and took me to the big hospital in downtown Chicago, which is where I lived at the time, not the local hospital. So that was even more confusing to me. Like, why am I going to the big hospital, right? And I didn't really, I have to tell you, that's where my kind of suppression, repressed memories started. Because I don't remember much of what happened while I was there. And apparently I spent the whole day there doing psychological testing. And it was determined that I needed to go to therapy once a week for the next 6 years, as you talked about. And, you know, again, secrets and shame is what I learned at a very early age, because it was clearly I was a problem. Clearly something was wrong with me and nobody was telling me what it was. So as kids do, I just, you know, there must be something terribly wrong with me. And my dad was quite violent toward me in a way that he wasn't towards my brother. So that almost sealed the deal, if you will. Like, wow, there is really something wrong with me. Look at the way dad treats me compared to the way he treats my brother Ross. So it was a difficult period of time for me, honestly. And I really did learn how to push away and suppress who I was in order to be loved, like, you know, which is the title of the book.
Indeed.
I think everybody wants that, right? And that's what my whole life's journey was about. It's like, what's wrong with me? How do I be different so that my dad will love me? And, you know, there was, as fascinating as this is, and I say it fascinating now, Marty, because it blows my mind that in 6 years of weekly therapy, I have two memories of sessions. I went a lot, and it really, I've racked my brain to try to recover more of what happened. But the two memories I have is one, the beginning of the therapy, you know, sitting down at a desk and drawing a picture of my family. And then this psychiatrist kind of asked me to store questions about my family. who's this, who's that? And that was kind of normal. He liked my artwork, so I thought, oh, maybe I'm a good artist. And then towards the end of the therapy session, I remember another session where we were playing with boy toys on the carpeting. And I didn't want like none of the toys. He had two dressers, right? One was boy toys and one was girl toys. And I wasn't even interested in any of them. I remember like, ugh, army men, battleships, like I don't really care about this stuff. He's like, these are the toys we have to play with. I was like, oh, okay. And so we played army men and battleship on the rugs, on the on the floor, sitting on the rug. And I just remember that so vividly. And it just shocks me that that's what I remember out of the hours and hours and hours of being there as a little kid.
Well, and you're talking about, I guess it's now completely discredited conversion therapy, the idea of turning you into a real little boy.
That's right. That's right. Exactly. And it's interesting because my parents now, my mom will say to me in retrospect, oh my goodness, Frankie, we sent you to a form of conversion therapy. We had no idea that that's what it was. What we did know is that we wanted the best for you. We wanted you to grow up like a normal boy, and we did everything in our power to help you with that. So in this way, for the times, they were well intended because I got caught playing in my cousin's basement with a Barbie doll. And I remember somebody yelling at me like, Frankie, get out of there. Don't do that. You're not supposed to play with those toys. I don't even know who it was, to tell you the truth, but that's what I know. Like, uh-oh, I did something wrong. And my parents reached out to my uncle, my dad's brother, who was a doctor at the time, and he's the one that said, I think you should send him to therapy so we can make him be a normal boy kind of thing. Get rid of those impulses to play with a Barbie doll.
Yeah, and one imagines for 6 years from 6 to 12, when children are not sort of in the process of knowing who they are sexually, to be under that kind of therapy. Let me ask you about your dad, and I mentioned that in my introduction, and you write quite a bit about his emotional and physical abuse, chasing you around, hitting you for no apparent reasons. I mean, for things that seem to come out of nowhere. I mean, that is trauma. What was that effect on you?
Profound, I would say. Now, even you
I bet.
naming it, even you naming it, like brings up emotion for me because that was such a terrifying, terrifying experience. And I took years and years and years to actually be able to feel the impact of it. I had memory. I'm a smart kid, so I always had the details, but I really pushed the feelings away. And there was this, like, it was like if looks could kill, like I'd see the look in his eyes, and I was like, I'm in trouble. And I would run. To this day, Marty, I'm a runner. I still run. I ran yesterday, right? I've been running my whole life in this way with quick reflexes and get away, get away, get away. So I would run throughout the house. He would yell and scream at me, run upstairs and lock the bedroom door as quickly as possible. We had one of those push button locks, and I was running up the stairs two at a time, and I couldn't remember. Push the button, push the button, push the button. Because once I shut that door and it locked, he would pound on the door, screaming obscenities at me. Some of them I didn't even know what they were, but I'm like, this, they're clearly bad, right? I'm clearly bad. And I would watch, like, this is what happens in trauma. I know this as an expert. Like, I focused on the hinges on the door. Like, that's what I kept looking at because the hinges would move back and forth when he would pound on the door in his rage. And I would think like, oh my God, if those hinges break, I'm dead. Like, and I just remember the hinges. Like, I just focused on the hinges and, terrifying. Oh, like over and over and over again, this happened. And the thing that was kind of shocking for me in retrospect was those episodes happened after I started therapy because there was a no hitting rule that the therapist came up with. So my dad apparently hit me when I was before 6 years old, right? And I know about that now as the story unfolds. But that was after the no hitting rule, right? So he would yell and scream instead of hit. So it was horrible, honestly. It was horrible, and it set up a trajectory for me of which is so confusing. I have to tell you, it was so confusing to like be so terrified to hate this man who treated me so badly and to desperately want his love. Because what I ended up doing was becoming this like amazing student who got straight A's, who excelled. I constantly wanted him to be proud of me. And you know, now I can understand that complexity as a adult, but as a kid, it was like, it just didn't make any sense to me. Why do I want this person who hates me so much to love me? Like, you know, kids can't hold that complexity.
Well,
So,
it's very confusing. You use a two words in the book, trauma bond. Is that what you're talking about? That there's this connection. This is the name of the show, but there's a connection that develops between the person who was being victimized and the victimizer.
well, it's interesting. So, yes, there's that level of trauma bonding, right? Which is the complexity of loving someone who's harmful to you, right? That's one form of trauma bonding. The other form of trauma bonding that I experienced, so exactly what you're talking about, and it's too complicated for kids, right? The other form of trauma bonding that I referenced too is the way my brother and I were traumatically bonded to each other. So him, my brother and I were 20 months apart, and we were bonded together by trauma, meaning he was my savior. He was my safe person. He didn't get abused as much as I did, but we were like huddled together as a unit and as a team against the world. Do you know what I mean? So we were bonded because of our trauma in a very positive way. My brother is one of the people I love the most in the world still to this day. So there's a trauma bond around rescue and saving each other is one form of trauma bonding. And then the other is trauma bonded to being, you know, bonded to the abuser with the complexity of loving and needing and wanting them while they're also so harmful to you. So it's super complicated on many different levels.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're up on a break, and I do want to take that very short break and get back to our conversation. Our guest is psychiatrist Frank Anderson, and we're talking about his new book. It's a memoir titled To Be Loved, A Story of Truth, Trauma, and Transformation. And he is a leading authority on the psychology of trauma, of healing from trauma. And the book is about his own experience of trauma as a kid growing up in a violent family, especially with a violent father, and how he has worked his way throughout the other side. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, talking with Frank Anderson. He is an expert in trauma, and he's written a memoir, To Be Loved, A Story of Truth, Trauma, and Transformation. And we've been talking about his childhood growing up in a chaotic and violent household, how he had to endure the physical and emotional abuse from his own father. Let me ask you, because you are an expert in trauma, looking at your own childhood and the kind of response that you had to the trauma in your childhood growing up, what are the kind of typical responses? What is the architecture, I guess I'm asking, of childhood trauma?
So the architecture, it's a good question, is, you know, I think about the responses. So there's a range of responses. When you talk about the architecture of trauma is what happens to us, it's what we endure. And then our responses are really kind of the telltale signs. Most people don't have a good understanding of connecting the dots linking the responses to the events of the trauma. So most kids will do a range of things. And when we look at the neurophysiology or the neurobiology of trauma or post-traumatic stress disorder, there are two extremes. We can go up or we can go down, right? Hmm. We can be what's called parasympathetically activated, fight or flight. Oh my gosh, I'm panicking, I'm freaking out. Reactivity, high emotionality, right? There's one pole that we can go to physiologically, which is the activated pole, right? And behaviors that are out of control, highly emotional, highly reactive. That's one type of response. The other pole, if you will, is hypo-aroused or blunted, disconnected, dissociated. That's the other extreme that often happens with people: shut down, dissociated, numb, withdrawn, depressed, non-responsive. Which, you know, dissociating, living in another world, so to speak. Right? Yeah. Go ahead.
I was going to say which was you, or were you a combination of the two?
I was a combination of the two, and there were moments where I would be highly reactive and emotional. And then there were moments where I would totally shut down and disconnect for survival's sake. So, you know, most people have a range of responses, as I did. And sometimes people lean one towards more one than the other, right? There were moments of time, like when I was running through the house, trying to get away from him, boy, was I activated. I was in fight or flight, flee mode, right? Do everything I can. And I was quick. Right. And then there are other times I remember being kind of stuck in the car. We went to Florida driving from Chicago. And I just was like, I know this is a 20 hour drive. I know how to get through this drive. And I just dissociated. Like, I was like, I'm going to leave and let's see how much time passes, because I knew I had the capacity to disconnect in such a profound way. So, you know, I went both ways depending on the circumstance. There were times after I'd had one of those kind of violent episodes with my father, my mom would constantly kind of knock on the door to soothe me, you know, and she was invested in keeping the family together at all costs for her own trauma history, if you will. And she would, you know, he's okay, everything's fine, Frankie, your father loves you, your father loves you. You know, she did her desperation in her need to stay connected to her husband and her son. And those were the moments that I can remember being totally deflated and depleted. Like, I just felt so helpless in those moments. Like, I was so stuck. What do I do? And I remember being very kind of disconnected and withdrawn and hopeless. In that response. So, you know, there's quite a wide range. And, you know, some people are not aware that some kids are really good at hiding both, right? And they look as if nothing's wrong. One of the things that was really surprising to me, not surprising in not a shocking way, more in a, like a, I had empathy for my cousins, because as I wrote this book, most of the family did not know what went on behind closed doors. Yeah. We always presented well, right? I knew when that door opened and people showed up, you smiled and you presented well and behaved well. And so my cousins, when they read this, they were kind of shocked that, Frankie, we had no idea that this was going on. We never, you looked like the perfect family. You always were such a good boy. You did so well. You were so funny. You know, so they were kind of shocked to hear that this was happening, because I did a lot to, you know, put it away and show up the way I knew I was supposed to.
Well, we have talked about the conversion therapy that you were in for something like 6 years. I'm curious about what, when one suppresses who one is, one's actual identity. I guess the kind of work that goes into that, but maybe it is also dissociation. You just cut yourself off from this part of yourself.
100%. 100%. Like, I didn't know who I was. I created a persona, right? The good thing that I was smart. Like, I didn't feel smart at the time. I really didn't. But I was smart enough to figure it out. I'm like, I've got to figure this out or I'm gonna get killed. So I figured out how to be. I figured out what people wanted. I remember looking at my uncles and say, I gotta act like this. I gotta have that kind of response. Like I knew I had to be act like a man in order to, not get in trouble and to be liked. So I did disconnect profoundly from who I was in order to create this persona. Like one of the things that was always striking to me is, when I was older, like say in college, I would watch a movie and if there was a sad scene, I'd cry. It's like, I remember that was a moment where I could activate excess, I should say, emotion. And it was always in displacement through a movie. And like I'd watch somebody have a death, right, in a movie. At the ending, they put the sad part on. And I'd cry and cry and cry. And I was like, why am I crying? Like nobody died. I don't have any sadness in me. Like I was so disconnected, but sometimes it would be activated by watching something on TV. It was like a clue that there was something else going on below the surface. Because I was really, really disconnected. I mean, I married, I talk about this in the
Yeah,
book.
you
I
got
married a
married to a
woman,
woman.
like, okay, this is what you're supposed to do. Like she was a friend of mine. Like I liked her as a person, but no way was, did I even know what, I didn't even know what being in love would feel like. I had no access or capacity to be in love with anybody. Like this is what men do. She's a nice person. I'll marry her. I was very kind of, cognitive or intellectual in that way. So, I was very, very disconnected from myself. I look at pictures and I, looked like a Harvard professor because I went to Harvard for psychiatry. Like, I have to have a beard. I have to wear a certain type of glasses. I must wear a suit and tie. Everything was kind of orchestrated and figured out, right? Constructed, if you will, to be who I thought the world wanted and needed me to be in order to be liked.
Well, you describe your marriage to Beth and getting really angry at her because you felt like she was not being honest with you. And you say, all I ever wanted was honesty, honesty, honesty. Meanwhile, you were living a double life. You know, you were going out sort of cruising for men at night and living with, I guess, Beth during the day. I don't know if it was that discreet or that sharply divided. But this, it's so interesting to want something that someone isn't doing for themselves anyway.
100%, right? Like that was such a the paradox of that's the paradox of, I would call it the trauma response, but also not accessing and healing your trauma, right? I was not in the mode of, I say I was in rinse and repeat mode, not heal mode. That's the way I describe it. Because on one hand, I was desperate for her to be honest with me because my mother kept betraying me. Your father loves you, your father loves you. And that was not what I experienced at all. Right. So I never trusted my mom's words. And I desperately wanted a woman to be honest with me. Don't tell me what you need me to hear or what you think I want to hear. Be truthful. So on one hand, I was desperate for her honesty, right? Because that was the only way I thought I could feel safe in a relationship. And yet also, and I was acting like my father. I became controlling. I was kind of yelling at her at times when she would lie at me. And I was mortified at my behavior, right? So I kind of hated her for being like my mom, hated me for being like my dad. I totally recreated my parents' scenario. And all along, underneath the facade, is a gay person who wanted to be himself,
Yeah, and be
right? So
loved.
it would, and be loved, right? So, you say, how do you do that? It's, this is the beauty and the curse of both of us being in medical school and in residency, is we would be on call and work for 36 hours at a time. And when our call schedules were not on the same track, she wouldn't be there. So I would go out and have my secret life, right? And so it was this horrible paradox, so disconnected. Like, how could you be angry at someone when you're doing a version of the same thing? And that was kind of, I would tell you, Marty, that was like kind of where things started. I
Yeah.
was in enough therapy at that time, and it was kind of like the walls started breaking down. I was like, I can't do this anymore. Like, I cannot live this lie. And all along, when I was like kind of having anonymous sex with men, I kind of, it would pop into my head like, maybe you're gay, but that was so unacceptable to grow up in a conservative Midwestern family. I knew in my head for sure I would lose my whole family.
By coming
So,
out.
oh my goodness,
Yeah.
totally. I used to hear horrible things about gay people growing up, racial slurs and things like homophobic comments. And so it was just not an option to be me. So I kept pushing it away. And of course, you can't do that. It doesn't work.
Yeah, let me just jump in here because I do need to reintroduce you. That's Frank Anderson, our guest today on The Connection. We're talking about his new book. It's a memoir titled To Be Loved, A Story of Truth, Trauma, and Transformation. That pretty much covers what we have been talking about. He is also an expert and authority on trauma, on things like PTSD. Well, I don't want to jump too far ahead, but needless to say, you did come out. You were 32 years old. And as you write about it, it's going to be different for everybody, that this was a real process for you. You had to sort of do it step by step and sort of, I guess, what, rediscover or discover who you are or who you were as a gay man?
Yes, 100%. Yeah, and it wasn't a rediscovery, it was a discovery because
Right.
I think I was pretty disconnected from who I was for most of my life, starting at 6 years old, as we talked about earlier. So it was a redis it was a discovering, honestly. And the thing that I can say in retrospect now is, I couldn't even entertain identity until I processed enough of my trauma. I have this saying that I wrote about in my second book, trauma blocks love, love heals trauma. And that was really my experience. The trauma I experienced blocked my own love and self-love and connection. So I didn't have access to me because my trauma history was blocking who I was. So and everybody has a different order, Marty. Like everybody does this process differently, as you alluded to. I needed to process my trauma enough in order to then start even looking at who I am. And
Well,
I came out late. So yes, go ahead.
no, I was going to say late, but I guess never. It's never too late. It's never too late to be who you
That's
are,
exactly
right?
right.
Yeah,
Right.
but
Oh my goodness. Yes.
but interestingly, and you touched on this earlier, is you did this with your wife, is when you and your husband had two little boys growing up, and one had special needs, the pressure really got to you, and you saw yourself acting, recreating the kind of relationship that your father had with you that you were having, especially with one of your children.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I mean, that was another talk about being mortified,
Yeah.
right? And the work that I've done, there's nothing more devastating in my experience is when someone who's been victimized gets awareness of their internal perpetrator. Everybody who's been
Powerful.
victimized internalizes perpetrator energy. And that awareness is mortifying. It is the moment in my life, or the moments in my life when I felt suicidal. It was like, if I'm going to do what was done to me, I'd rather be dead. And I remember feeling that very clearly because there was a way that I did a piece of work in healing, enough healing my trauma that I was able to come out, be who I was, and find a healthy relationship with a loving man. So that was a huge accomplishment for me in my life,
Sure.
right? To be able to do that. And then I've always loved children and I've always wanted kids. And I'm going to have kids, even if I'm gay, I don't care. I just had that kind of spirit about me. And then to have these children, and then to have what I would say a deeper layer of my trauma resurface, because children are primitive. Like children are primitive and immature by definition. That's what they're supposed to do, right? And that behavior in them, hitting each other, punching, throwing things, activated terror inside of me. Because I remember thinking, oh my, I remember feeling panic again. Like, oh my God, if I did anything like that, my dad would have beat me. Oh my goodness, I need to stop their behavior so I don't feel so anxious inside, right? So there was this layer, a deeper, much deeper layer, which children often do access deeper layers of our trauma than adults do. And so it brought up a very early young attachment trauma within me that got reactivated by the primitive nature of normal kid behavior.
Sure.
And that was so mortifying. Oh, my goodness.
Well, we're almost having a break here. But, you know, here you are, a respected trauma specialist,
right.
You know, living with your own unresolved trauma from your childhood with children. And I wonder whether, you know, being successful was a place that you could hide from your children. You could go out and be in the world and people would say, oh, Frank Anderson, you know, an expert in trauma. And then you go home and have to deal with difficult children.
Oh, my goodness. It was horrible. Let me tell you, it was like, how could I be the expert? Because, you know, when you grow up with verbal abuse, you internalize a very harsh critic. You internalize that verbal abuse. And so I was so brutal to myself, like, look at you. People come from all over the world to see you and look what you're doing to your children. You worthless piece of crap. Do you know what I mean? I was so critical and self-loathing of, I know what's better. I teach better for a living. And then to still not have the control over it, because as Bessel van der Kolk, one of my mentors, says, right, body keeps the score, right? That trauma was in my body. It was in my cells. And no amount of knowledge stopped that impulse that got activated within me. It shot me into therapy for another time. It's like, you know, but that was very painful. I did dive into expert land to counteract feeling so horrible about reenacting some of my dad's behavior.
Sure. Well, I want to talk about expert land and internal family systems after this very short break. And again, Frank Anderson is our guest today on the show. He's a psychiatrist, an expert in trauma, and has written a memoir, To Be Loved. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Mosco, and if you're just joining us, Frank Anderson is our guest. He's an expert in trauma as a psychiatrist treating patients, and from his public speaking, also from his own experiences as a kid growing up. And again, we've been talking about his new book, a memoir titled To Be Loved, A Story of Truth, Trauma, and Transformation. And Frank Anderson, you've been in therapy for many, many years in your life. Yes. There's nothing wrong with that. But one of the therapies or forms of therapy that I know that you both partake in and also are a proponent of is called internal family system. In a nutshell, how does that work? How does it look at the psyche? And how does it look at trauma?
Yeah, it's a great modality of therapy. It's wildly popular right now. There's a huge waiting list for therapists to get into it. And I think the reason that it's so popular is that there's a very relatable experiential component to the therapy internal family systems. And it basically says that we are all made up of different components or parts of our personality, that parts of our personality are normal, and that under extreme circumstances, our parts can take on extreme roles. Hmm. And so some of our parts carry pain and trauma. Some of our parts take on the role of protection to push the trauma away. So we have protective parts and we have parts that hold the pain or the wound. And another view of internal family systems is that we all within us have this concept they call self-energy. which means that we all have inherent wisdom and healing capacity within us. And it's helping a client access their internal wisdom and be in relationship to their parts, both protective and wounded, that is how we heal trauma. And I, you know, I'm one of the people who is a lead trainer at the IFS Institute and created the trauma curriculum. Once again, not only the expert in it, but the person who experienced it. So I think it's a very effective model for healing trauma because it helps these parts transform to be able to release the trauma that they hold and to let go of their protective roles once the wound has been healed, so they no longer have to serve the function of protection.
You describe in your book going through therapy and sort of re-experiencing your childhood. I started having nightmares again, just like in my childhood. I startled easily, became guarded, mistrusting of people, and at one point developed symptoms of depression. That part of what you had to go through, I guess, why you connect with your childhood is to relive it, and it was so difficult, so terrifying.
Well, let me say, you know, our field has come a long way. So when I was having kind of reliving that trauma, that was in my residency at Harvard Medical School. And we've come a long way with our trauma healing modalities now. Back then, there was too much reliving and not enough being with. A lot of the newer models of therapy, such as internal family systems, EMDR, somatic experiencing, or sensory motor psychotherapy, two body-based models, really help people be with the trauma, not in the trauma. Because we know now from neuroscience that reliving trauma is not helpful.
Yeah.
So there is a way to move through healing, which is not reliving and re-experiencing, because that reinforces the trauma neural network. So back in those days, I did some of that reliving, and it was quite re-traumatizing to some degree.
So we're
go ahead.
No, I was going to say, obviously, learning from the past, but also you
yes.
say is that back in the day, trauma was associated with warfare, and that we have a much
yeah.
bigger understanding about, first, I guess, how common trauma is, but also
yes.
its impact on variety of different experiences and the people experiencing those experiences.
Yeah, when I'm working with Bessel van der Kolk, really since 1992, a lot of his career was focused on making complex PTSD or relational trauma an official diagnosis. Because for years and years and years, in all the diagnostic statistical manuals, right, they all talked about PTSD as related to war, right, and symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder in that kind of way. But Betzel has really been a warrior, if you will,
yeah.
of bringing this diagnosis of complex PTSD or relational trauma, growing up with dysfunctional families, as a diagnosis with some separate symptoms. It's this ongoing relational betrayal. You know, every time your parent yells at you, every time your parent is depressed and withdrawn or neglectful, you lose a safe parent. And that's a loss of a safe parent. And it's a trauma of a betrayal of the parents that children need. So that whole diagnosis is something very different. And we've come a long way, and we do have more treatments now to address relational trauma as opposed to war trauma.
Now, that's good to know. You were estranged from your parents, from your dad, for a number of years. As he got older and more infirmed, you reconnected with him. Did he still scare you as an older, infirmed, frail old man?
No, he didn't. It was such a transformation. You know, you did talk, Marty, about all the years of I've been in therapy. And, you write a book, you have to add up the years. I was been in therapy for 33,
Good for
61
you.
Years.
Yeah.
Like, that's a lot of therapy. I'm not
that's
saying
okay.
everybody needs to go to therapy that much. But what was really surprising for me is I did have 7 years of no contact with my parents, because as I discovered my trauma history and tried to talk to them about it, they were really not open. They were full of denial. They did, how dare you say this? This didn't happen. This isn't true. I wasn't strong enough to stand my own on my own 2 feet, to stand my ground in the midst of their denial. So I disconnected from them so that I can be stronger and know clearly about what happened to me. Never thought it would take 7 years. That was never my intention. And when I healed enough of my trauma and became strong enough, I was able to re-enter the family, kind of like, you can say whatever you want. I know what happened to me, right? And that 7 years of no contact really did have a pretty significant impact on my parents too, because they realized that they no longer had power and control over me, and that if they wanted me in their life in any way, they had to be more open and accommodating to me and my truth. So it was, the reunion that we had with them over years, I knew more of who I was. I had come out by then. I knew what happened to me. I didn't need validation from them. And I had a cordial relationship, I would say.
Cordial.
Cordial. And I, Michael
Light.
and I had my, we had a son, and I wanted my kids to know their extended family and their cousins. I grew up in a big Italian family, so I wanted my children to have a sense of family outside of just my husband and I. So I did re-enter the family, and it was pretty good. It was pretty, I still didn't love or feel love for my father, even after the re-entry. I healed a lot of my trauma. I no longer had symptoms of PTSD, but I didn't really feel love for or from him until he, started deteriorating. He was very frail, and I started going back home to help take care of him, help my mom and my sisters. And that's where, like, a different level of transformation occurred. Me spending time with him in a fragile, much more vulnerable state.
You write about the struggle, I guess struggle is the right word, to forgive him, or to sort of what it took for you to be able to forgive him and what that meant, obviously, for you. When it comes to
Yes.
trauma, and I'm thinking of even people beyond yourself, I mean, how important, how necessary is forgiveness when it comes to dealing with trauma? Do you have to do
That's a
that?
great question. And everybody says, do you have to forgive in order to heal?
Right.
And by no means would I force anyone into forgiveness. I really do believe forgiveness is a choice. And I think forgiveness is more about the person doing the forgiving than it is about the person being forgiven. And I think that's an important distinction for people to make. I say you forgive if you want to release what you're carrying about the person who harmed you. Forgiveness doesn't let the person off the hook. Forgiveness doesn't condone what they've done. Forgiveness frees you up for feeling anger and resentment towards the person who harmed you. I think about forgiveness after healing trauma. I think what happened to you first, and then if you choose to, you can work on releasing the relational dynamics that still tie you to the person who harmed you. So that's the way I see forgiveness after what I've been through personally, right? And the other thing I'll say about forgiveness, which was very surprising for me, Marty, I did not expect this at all, is once I did enough of my own healing, once I felt really good about myself, I was able to see the humanity in my father, especially when he was fragile and sick and no longer kind of loaded with his defenses. It's like, this is a wounded person. This person is limited and they are wounded. And I saw the pain, the wound in him after I healed the wounded me. And that helped me. I'm going to use this word. I'm going to use the L word here. I was able to love him even though he harmed me. And honestly, that is one of the most freeing experiences I've had in relation to my trauma, is to love someone who harmed you truly is an experience of rising above what happened to you.
Absolutely. And it reminds me of someone that I know who had a difficult relationship with his father, who says now, I have a much better relationship with my father now that he's dead. And I can, I can love him and understand him in a way that I never could when he was alive.
Yes, that's right. And what I would say, and this was a gift for me, is that I had a moment towards the end of my dad's life where I felt his love for the first time in my life. So I had a powerful corrective experience with him. And I believe feeling love from him enabled me to also feel love for him. You know, love is a complicated issue for many of us, right? We're searching for it our whole lives. But love for me is this exchange, a soul to soul connection. And I think it's hard to feel that for someone when you haven't felt it from them. I think it's possible, but I also think it's more challenging. So I did go through these experiences that I never would have expected. And, you know, I can acknowledge my anger and I don't hold on to it anymore. And I can feel much freer to love. And the other thing, Marty, that was again a shock was I was able to forgive myself.
That was one of my questions, whether how much of forgiveness was forgiving yourself for what?
For all that I had done in my life, not only to my kids or my ex-wife, but to myself. You know, one of the things I heard when I was writing this book was, you need to forgive yourself for staying too long in relationships that were harmful to you. And I thought, wow, that's true. There was a self-forgiveness. I stayed too long, desperate to be loved in things that weren't healthy for me. So there's a self-forgiveness. I could apologize so much easier now. Gosh, I made a mistake. I am so sorry. Like, you know, holding someone to an unrealistic standard holds yourself to an unrealistic standard too. And I'm not condoning harm, but I do believe this was important for me to write about. We all have harmed and we all have been harmed. I think that's the only way we're truly going to heal trauma is to acknowledge both sides in everyone.
We're almost out of time here. How much has writing, and you actually write about this, but how much has writing helped you heal? The idea that you sort of put your feelings, your memories on paper.
It was hugely healing. I thought this book was for everyone else, and it is. I'm so touched by the ways my story, I talk about my collection of moments, the way my moments have affected people, the way people resonate. The main reason I wrote this book was to let people know that trauma is a universal experience and that healing is possible for everyone. I really feel that deeply. Mm-hmm. And that's the main reason I wrote the book. I wasn't expecting to have this profound level of healing beyond therapy as a result of writing. I'm doing writing courses now, Write to Heal, for example, to let people know that this is a very powerful modality for healing trauma, also as writing.
Well, we're almost out of time. As I mentioned, is it ever too late to have a good or a better childhood?
No, nope. 61, still working on it. I always will be. I think we're always going to be growing. I don't think we end. It's part of the journey.
And are you going to stay in therapy for the rest of your life?
As long as I can, as long as my therapist and I are both alive and kicking, I'm going to be there. That's for sure. Yeah, I'm never going to stop growing. There's layers and layers of growth. There's layers and layers of elevating love and connection that I keep experiencing that I want to keep sharing with the world. So I'm not stopping anytime soon.
Well, Frank Anderson, thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure. Thanks for joining us today on The Connection. We've used that word a lot during this hour.
Yes, thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And again, his book is titled To Be Loved, A Story of Truth, Trauma, and Transformation. And he is a leading authority on the subject of trauma. Well, thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection that airs every Friday and Sunday at noon right here on WHYY. You can download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow us on Instagram and you can find us on Facebook. Check out our website, whyy.org/theconnection, for more information about upcoming shows and to sign up for our newsletter. Debbie Builder produces The Connection along with Paige Murray Bessler. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Have a great weekend, and thanks for joining us.